It is Saturday, July 5th, 2008, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, we have an interview with author William Gibson. Welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KOSP. This episode of GeekSpeak is pre-recorded because the geeks are enjoying American Independence Day. I hope you are enjoying your 4th of July weekend as well. But we have a real treat for you today. And in just a minute, I'll tell you what it is. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. A few weeks ago, Rick Kleffel, one of the hosts of KOSP's Talk of the Bay, invited Sean Cleveland and me to join him in a discussion with William Gibson about his new book, Spook Country. We had so much fun talking about fiction. The following week, we spoke with author Kathleen Ann Gunnan about science fiction. And next week, we're speaking with author Jay Lake about his follow-up to Mindspring called Escapement, which is out in hardbound. If you're interested in any topics you've heard on GeekSpeak before, of course, you can go to the GeekSpeak website, geekspeak.org, and download the podcast and see the discussion about the show, notes, and things of that nature. And, of course, we do help people all week long on our forums. Just geekspeak.org to get that kind of help. William Gibson is best known for his 1982 book, Neuromancer, which helped to imagine and conceptualize the internet as we know it today. And he is one of the originators of the cyberpunk genre of science fiction. You could call him the father of the cyberpunk genre of science fiction. Sean Cleveland is one of the regular hosts of GeekSpeak, knows all about computer hardware, has a wonderful science fiction collection, and is currently senior technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Rick Kleffel does a lot of author interviews for KOSP and NPR and is an avid collector and reader of fiction. He hosts this interview. Enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's say hello to William Gibson. William, I'd like to talk to you first about your new book, Spook Country. One thing that I noticed about it when I was revisiting it again recently was that there's a theme in this novel that I think carries through all your work, in which we have a technological means of putting something between us and the world, so that there's a way of filtering our vision of the world. We saw the spectacles that Molly wore in Neuromancer, and we have the locative art spectacles that enable us to see art around the world imposed on our natural environment. And I was thinking that, as it happens, for many people, Neuromancer was a form of that same kind of spectacles that really changed the way we saw the world. And I wonder if you thought of your fiction as a sort of means of imposing locative art upon those who read it.
Well, that's an interesting... Excuse me. That's a little intense. That's an interesting way of looking at it. But I... You know, my... thank you. That's much better. I'm definitely a native of science fiction, but I haven't been a science fiction nationalist since I was about 15 years old. And I started to write fiction in my mid to late 20s. And the fiction I wound up writing... was science fiction, but I think I was in some ways unusually self-aware. I knew that I wasn't really writing about the future, and I didn't actually care very much about the predictive capacity of my work. I had taken J.G. Ballard's dictum that from the 60s that Earth is the alien planet, quite literally. And I felt like I was using science fiction's, the toolkit that I had acquired as a kid reading science fiction, I felt that I was using those tools in the investigation of the reality that was facing me on the day that I wrote the fiction. And in that regard, I don't think what I do has ever changed very much. I'm still doing that. I've just dropped, maybe temporarily, the cultural convention that I'm writing about some imaginary future.
And the future you're writing about in this is the now, really. In fact, now that it's been out for a little bit, it's 2006, I think, is your date on the time period. And the virtual reality that you use, of course, is mixed. Rick, you just mentioned locative art, but William, would you be willing to introduce what that is?
Well, it's actually what I'm describing in the book was I saw described a decade or more ago as blended reality, BR as opposed to VR. And in blended reality, there's a GPS factor involved that keeps your virtual objects aligned with the grid, so they're always in one place, or possibly they're moving around, but they're moving around in relationship to physical reality.
So in Neuromancer, for example, the people plug in and they completely lose touch with this reality and are in a different space, almost 100%. And in this book that you're talking about now with Locative Art, you put on a visor that's actually semi-transparent, and you're in a world that you're both mixed with the current reality that we're all aware of and a computer-generated one on the same at the same time.
Yeah, but I was also doing a kind of retro future nostalgic nod to that goggles and gloves version of VR, which has, you know, thoroughly joined the flying car as one of those technologies we're never going to get.
What happened? But we should.
Well,
we were promised as kids.
Yeah, but what turned out to override that is if the content of the medium is sufficiently engrossing, you don't need any helmet.
Yeah,
I don't. People playing those massively multiplayer online games don't need any goggles. They're like in the game, and the old model of VR was the product of a day in which cyberspace had not yet turned itself inside out and colonized the entire physical
world.
What
do you mean by that? Are we living in cyberspace now?
I think we are. I literally think we are, and I don't think we're really aware of it yet.
Well, right before we started the show, I went ahead and opened up my portable device and Twittered, basically telling a whole bunch of people that subscribe to me that I'm speaking with you live now on KOSP, and realized that, of course, that's my connection to the virtual space, yeah. And I have it on me all the time. So is that kind of what you're talking about?
Well, yeah, that, and if we had a pair of magic goggles that allowed us to see packets of information traveling between devices. Can you imagine what a street in New York or Paris would look like? Would just be completely, completely busy and cluttered with the wireless information that's being exchanged. Cyberspace used to be something that you'd have to sit down at a big machine to access. And what we have now is something very different. We physically live in a cloud of disinformation, but it's invisible, and our interface devices don't allow us to be
overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, to be overwhelmed by it. But when I started writing, the other place, cyberspace, was the other place. And it was exotic and romantic. But today, the other place is where you don't have Wi-Fi. The other place has become a lack of connectivity. And that's what we register as, whoa, that's different.
Right. You can want to talk to William Gidson. You can call us at 1-800-655-5877 or 476-2800. I'm your host, Rick Kleffel, joined by Lyle Troxell and Sean Cleveland. We've got William Gibson here. William, one thing I noticed across, or actually, this is a question from my wife. She noticed that you have a lot of female protagonists. You use female protagonists a lot in your work. Could you talk about why you choose female protagonists?
Well, they're, you know, I find them better company over the long haul of writing a book. I can't imagine why I would want to write a book that had exclusively male protagonists. It's just never occurred to me. And historically, I think a relevant factor there is that when I started writing science fiction, I went out and read a bunch of contemporary science fiction. That would have been about 1979. And I was drastically underwhelmed by what was being written, with the exception of some radical feminist SF that was mostly coming out of the Pacific Northwest.
Which authors?
Oh, Ursula Le Guin, Joanna Russ, and Vonda McIntyre come to mind. And they were the only people at that point who I thought were doing anything radical with science fiction.
One of the things that I noticed about your most recent work is this: you have this idea of vision of America as having a cold civil war, and that's getting hotter lately. Could you talk about that concept, which I think is a really interesting vision of our nation now? And indeed, it's kind of engulfing the globe.
I don't know. I don't have an expressed political philosophy much. And one of the reasons I write fiction is to discover where I am at the moment. And this book is set in the year before it was published, or the year before it was first published. So it's actually set in the year in which I wrote it. It's kind of early in the year in which I wrote it. And one thing, if you follow the background very carefully through the book, you realize that most of these characters, with the possible exception of one or two, don't know anything about the information harvesting operations that were underway in the United States at the time this action is taking place. I think Mr. Big End knows, because he's going to get set up with a dark net, and he's long since quit trusting the right telephone.
Now, a dark net is something like the internet, but not connected.
Yeah.
That's a really interesting idea. I like that.
We have a question from phone-in question. They're offline. They say, Timothy Leary, neuromancer to computer gaming world, funding fell through. Do you have any similar ventures in the future, either for the big screen or on the computer?
Well...
Tell us about the Timothy Leary thing. That's fascinating.
I never knew all of what Tim was up to. I don't know if I don't know if anyone did, and it was a long time ago, so I actually don't know. There is a very old Neuromancer film deal that the clock is running out on. So there's some remote chance that someone may be able to get a studio deal to make a feature of Neuromancer before the last possible day. But
it usually happens that way.
Yeah, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Are you interested in working on a film like that? Or would you just let it go?
Given the experience I've had with that sort of thing, I think I'd just let it
cross
go.
Your fingers and hope they did
well,
a good job.
I wouldn't even do that. I'd just, pay no attention and go to see it when it comes out. And chances are I wouldn't be that enthralled with it, but it wouldn't be my aesthetic responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not your form.
Have you written anything outside of prose? I mean, I wrote
the screenplay for the feature film we shot as Johnny Mnemonic, but that wasn't what you got to see when Johnny Mnemonic was released. And I wrote a couple of X-Files episodes, mm-hmm. which was it's kind of the two extremes of my screenwriting experience with Johnny Mnemonic and the X-Files. It's sort of the bad and the good.
Did you like the X-Files experience?
Yeah, very much. And one of the things that's great about that is that the relative degree of freedom you have in terms of seeing what, deciding what you want to write and seeing what you want to write realized on the screen was much, 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 much higher. There's something to do with the difference in the amount of money involved. X-Files was about $1 million an episode.
Wow.
When I was doing that. And, feature films are a lot more.
Mm-hmm. I know that you don't claim to be a futurist, though people try to put that label on you all the time. I guess I'm to some degree a futurist. And when I'm reading the most recent book that's talking about the now and how computers are used to track things and how GPS is almost ubiquitous, it's really easy to put it in a small device. I kind of think about where the next step is, and I'm seeing a lot of parallels in some of the locative information that you're talking about as an art form and also for tracking part of the main plot line of the book. And I'm seeing that the devices that are coming in people's hands have these features, and there's a few more steps necessary to do the kind of transparency overlay of more information. But I'm using it all the time for navigation systems.
Yeah.
I understand that you and your publisher came in together in a car with a GPS system. That's locative art in some way, or at least it's information that's coming from the net to some degree and helping you navigate the real world.
Yeah. And lots of people are using that every day. The first locative art project I ever heard of was, I think, in Bloomsbury in London. And you'd go to an office in Bloomsbury, and they would you would ask for and be given a sort of tablet with some sort of audio device on it and some GPS features. And you would go out walking through Bloomsbury, and as you passed certain points, you would hear something that an artist had put together for that particular point. And they were like wildly varied. One might be a game that someone had figured out you could play with the facade of an actual building. And another would be someone's like heartbroken confessional about the last time they ever saw the one woman they truly loved on the doorstep of this very particular building, and you're standing right there by the doorstep.
This sounds like a piece by Warren Sack, who's a faculty member at UCSC, I work with Warren, and it's very much you know where you are. This piece is called Street Stories, and you walk around with a portable device with GPS, and you can either record a story or you can walk through other stories. And it's very much that kind of where you are to find the content you get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that sort of put the locative art idea on the map for me, and I was interested in using it in this book mainly as a sort of symbolic representation of this feeling I have that cyberspace has turned itself inside out and colonized everything, and we haven't really quite grasped that yet. I think there's been a big change over the last decade or the past 15 years, and we're still waiting for the next recognized change. But I think there's been a big change that we haven't really recognized, because it's been
slow.
It's been gradual. It's been gradual but steady.
It's the boiling a frog phenomenon.
Yeah, boiling the cyber frog.
We're taking your email questions, KUSP@KUSP.org, or your phone-in questions at 1-800-655-5877. I'm your host, Rick Kleffel. We're here with William Gibson and Lyle Troxel and Sean Cleveland of GeekSpeak. We do have a question from the internet. This is from Andrew Hagman. He's a doctoral student in the Department of English at the University of California, Davis. And his question is, from the sky, the color of television tuned to a dead channel, an opening line we'll never forget, that opens Neuromancer to the annotated environments and locative art in Spook Country. Your writing consistently engages with intersections of technology and place or environment. Would you please remark on the trajectory of shifts in your configurations of this technology-environment intersection and the ways that it shaped your narratives from your early work to Spook Country?
Wow.
That was a PhD candidate.
Yeah. Well, that's a thesis right there. Well, my initial, my earliest inklings of cyberspace as an imaginary construct that I could use in the writing of science fiction probably had everything to do with standing outside old school video arcades and watching kids play these enormous car-sized, plywood-sided video games that were the first ones that were around. And what I think I did was I read in their posture this intense desire to reach through the screen and directly manipulate that information. And just that their posture suggested to me that there was, in some sense, a reality behind the screen.
Some place they couldn't get to but wanted to.
Yeah, that there was this yearning to be beyond the screen. About the same time, I started seeing ads for the earliest home computers. And I realized that these home computers would be on desks and tables in people's homes, and that they had screens, and that behind the screens was some version of the same space that these kids in the arcade were yearning to dive into. For some reason, I took it for granted that the spaces behind each of those machines in individual homes and apartments would be the same space.
The invention of the net.
Yeah, possibly I had heard about the net to some extent, which did exist then, although there weren't that many people who were privy to it. And that was the begin. So I began with a sort of info-geographical metaphor. That had, you know, even someone trying to get to the other side of a screen is info-geographical in a micro sense. And I extended that out into an entire imaginary universe. And I suppose I've continued to do that because it's continued to work for me as some sort of description of reality. It works in a works for me in a very naturalistic way.
The metaphor of a space with computers has been a pretty standard thing, maybe a sense Neuromancer, but we all call the desktop this thing that actually exists, and of course it's not. It's It's a whole bunch of bits, but we do conceptualize it as a space, and visually we see it as a space, of course, on the screen. So it's kind of interesting that the entire idea. I mean, I think the stance that I wouldn't expect would be the idea that everybody's desktop's connected, that you saw even without really being aware that the net existed. Very enlightened way of thinking.
GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary, public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. This discussion, which originally aired June 10th on Talk of the Bay, features author William Gibson, geek Sean Cleveland, and is hosted by Rick Kleffel. William Gibson is traveling, promoting his paperback edition of his new book, Spook Country. We are not taking calls this week, but I welcome you to join us on the web. Go to geekspeak.org and click on the forums. You can ask us anything you'd like about technology and even help out with other people's questions and comments. Stay with KUSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Ardo.
We're talking with William Gibson, author of numerous science fiction novels, including Neuromancer. We're back. We have an offline question for Mr. Gibson. Is there any role for Luddites in your cyber world?
I suppose there is. I'm unable to.
Well, I can. Is my microphone on? I can give you an example. World of Warcraft, you've got people who are just making armor and doing things for other people who are in the game, who then buy that and then use it. That would be kind of like somebody, that's what they do. They go into the game, they actually build things, but they don't really adventure and do other things. But they seem to get happiness from that.
Yeah, that's kind of an alternative way of playing, if you will.
But, you know, when we were talking about how we are in a virtual reality, just in our own reality, I think I kind of get where you're coming from now. With locative art or augmented reality, as we're calling it, if we could actually take these visors, put them in a sunglass sort of, form factor, and we had enough 3D processing power to actually add virtual spaces in the real world, then we would really be in a, in an environment that is partial reality, but is kind of cyberspace too. It could be anything you want.
You know, Sean and I had a big discussion about the technology the other day when we knew that we were going to be talking with William Gibson. We talked about, well, what are the features that are lacking right now with what technology we have? And it's really close. That's what it feels like to me. I mean, we've got the gyroscopic tools are really cheap now, which is very important for detecting head movement. And then you need a massive amount, and then the GPS coordinates to give you general location.
They need to be a little better, though, GPS.
GPS needs to be better, but it actually, accurate. I think it needs to be visually based. And this is a camera, kind of like the Wii remote, where the Wii actually is tracking based off of imagery. It's receiving. Imagery it's receiving is a small reflectiveness of the screen and LED on the Wii remote. But basically having a few tether points to trap the image, to sync it, if you will, is a crucial part. And then a massive amount of low power processing.
Yeah, well, rendering high definition 3D so that it looks real among the actual real environment in a way that as you walk around it, it's rendering it in 3D so that you see perspective. Now, that's the tough part. That's
and
the
it
challenge.
Doesn't make you nauseous, because that's a big part of it, is if it's not locked on.
Well, I think
perfectly,
you wouldn't get nauseous because you're not in a virtual world. You're still grounded. And you're still seeing
right.
the real things around
right.
the object.
The earlier stages of these actually is pretty. And I think you even mentioned this in your book, William Gibson, that when the first time your protagonist puts the headset on, she's instructed by the artist that there's some lag. We accept that there's some lag. And I guess the question is it going to be at a state relatively soon where the lag won't be important?
Well, I don't think it's important now. I think actually one of the things that this is a process that you talk about called eversion, where cyberspace is inverted. We're more used to seeing computer graphics in some ways than we are to seeing reality in front of our eyes. I mean, you go to a movie and you see all these kind of graphics that are supposed to be hyper-real. To me, they still look like a computer game.
Sure.
Yeah.
William, we have a question for you. How do we deal with present pollution, energy, and climate changes realities in an energy-intensive technology?
Boy, I wish I knew. I'd have a whole other line of fiction. I would refer you to my colleague Bruce Sterling for that one, or to probably also to the more politically progressive but more traditionally hard science SF writers. I'm sort of a, you know, science fiction for me is some kind of flag of convenience, and it always has been. I'm, as many science fiction writers I'm sure would happily tell you, I'm not really doing the real thing.
Right. And you've actually created a whole subgenre of fiction, I would say. And so in that you're not hard fiction, that's for sure. But do you read a lot of hard fiction or hard sci-fi? Like, you know, real science?
I don't even read a lot of science fiction anymore. The only science fiction I want to read is science fiction that couldn't have been written 10 years ago, and there's hardly any around.
Uh-huh.
I think science fiction may actually be over. Science fiction as we knew it as a historical entity in the 20th century may turn out to have been part of 20th century modernism. My friend John Clute, the science fiction historian and critic, has been saying that for the past 5 or 6 years, that the world today, reality today, can't support what we used to do. And my expression of that in pattern recognition is the character who argues that the present today is too unutterably brief to support the Wellesian arc of extrapolation. When H.G. Wells thought about the present, he probably thought it was at least a couple of years long,
mm-hmm.
or a decade long. But for us, it's a news cycle or a fraction of a news cycle. The world will not hold still long enough to allow for classical acts of extrapolation. You literally can't do it today because you don't know where global warming, for instance, and that's only one factor, you don't know where that's going.
Right. I think it's interesting, when I was reading your book that you actually wrote in 2006, that so much of it is pretty valid still today. I mean, you're talking about the iPod with the white cables coming out of the ears. That's still going on. But it didn't have to be that way. It could have been that, you know, tomorrow Apple releases all black cables and that's what everybody has, and pretty soon your piece is dated right there in that timeline. And that's kind of what you're talking about, that the now is not very long.
Yeah, the now is not very long at all, and I'm all painted. It's really a kind of skin of your teeth operation to write speculative novels of the very recent past,
yeah.
which is what this is. But with the iPods, for instance, the kind of things that come into play for me writing in that time frame, a friend of mine said, you know, that's not the way they would do it. They would do it with these, you know, $4.95 keychain digital cameras, and that would do the trick. But I said, no, I don't. I want to be able to piggyback on all the money that Apple spent on making the iPod iconic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I want to get those iconics for free and legally. And the iPod is resonant in a way that a made in China keychain camera can never be.
I thought about that the entire time I was reading it. Like, why are these people using an iPod for data storage? There's a lot cheaper ways of doing it. In fact, there's examples in media controlled environments like Cuba where people are taking news stories, newspapers, on USB thumb drives and handing them around. And it's called sneaker net type stuff. And so why not use those? But you do cover that, because there's a discussion about how the information is actually encrypted and in music, and that's a very clever way to to put that iconography piece very important in it.
I was surprised that you kept Tower Records in there.
Tower Records was there when the action took place.
Yeah, that's
the very
that's
end
figured.
Of the very end of it. But it was by the time the book was published, it was gone. But I knew it was going to be gone when.
So yeah. You kind of wanted to hold on to it for a second.
Yeah, but it was also it was such a notable part of the geography of that very small piece of landscape that I worked so thoroughly there. That it was sort of one of my favorite parts of it.
Yeah.
We have a question from the internet, an email question. Japan and East Asia, how have your perceptions changed over the years since writing Neuromancer?
So when I wrote Neuromancer, I hadn't been to Japan. And then Neuromancer became a sort of instant success, the scandal in Japan, because I had a wonderful, crazy Japanese translator who did something terrifically transgressive with his translation, and the book got a lot more attention than it would have done otherwise. So I got to go to Japan, but I'm still I still am deeply enraptured with Japan and Tokyo in particular, and I think that I've come to suspect that that's because the Japanese have had the most hairy, extreme experience of techno shock. I think of any culture on Earth. They bought the entire Industrial Revolution kit from the British and the Americans in the 1890s, turned it on, and literally blew their brains out. 30 years later, they were this huge military-industrial machine taking over their part of the world. That didn't work out. They got nuked and put back together by some actually fairly enlightened American policy, and came back at us selling us cars and motorcycles and television sets. It's like no country on earth has a history anything like that. So I'm always deeply fascinated by their approach to technology. That was always what attracted me. It wasn't because of their bubble economy. It wasn't because Time magazine said that they were taking over the world in the 80s. It was because of what happened to them in the 1890s, mm-hmm. and in the Second World War, and then what they became.
You talk a bit about conspiracy in this book, but I understand that you're not a big conspiracist kind of person. What do you think about the reality of potential small conspiracies like the one that's in the main arc of this book?
Well, you know, there are the world is filled with small conspiracies and with some fairly large conspiracies too. Any policeman knows that. But what we call conspiracy theory is something else. And my rule of thumb for recognizing a conspiracy theory is anything that anyone can explain to you over the course of two pints of beer that purports to explain a big hunk of history is probably a conspiracy theory. And the appeal of conspiracy theories, regardless what they're about, and regardless of how dire they might seem, the appeal of them is that they're inherently comforting because they allow us to describe a world that is far less complex and random, hence less terrifying than the one we actually inhabit.
That's scary.
Support for Talk of the Bay is from Zachary's Restaurant. Zachary's Restaurant specializes in breakfast and lunch at 819 Pacific Avenue, serving Santa Cruz since 1985. Support for Talk of the Bay is also from American Chemistry Council. Recycling plastics gives them a second life and helps keep litter off California's beaches. Recycling plastics prevents waste, preserves resources, and protects the environment for future generations. Mr. Gibson, we have a question here from New Zealand, sent through us from cyberspace. To what extent do you see science fiction influencing the future?
I don't actually see science fiction influencing the future much now. I think science fiction influenced, science fiction was a big part of our culture of the future in the previous century, but the previous century was a century in which we actually believed that we had a future. We took it for granted that we had a future. And in the 21st century, we can't actually take it for granted in the same way that we even have a future. So,
well, why do you say that? I mean, the threat of nuclear annihilation seems to have receded slightly. I mean, we're not doing drop drills.
Yeah, that one's gone away. But now we're trying to figure out how badly we've damaged the planet's weather system, and that's actually a bigger problem. It's not going to go. That's not something that's going to go away. And we have a lot of other things going on as well. If I had gone into a publisher's office in 1981, the year that I started writing Neuromancer, and proposed writing a novel in which the unrecognized side, one of the unrecognized side effects of human technology for the past couple of hundred years was the chronic destabilization of Earth's weather systems, they might have said, yeah, that's not a bad plot driver. You know, go and see what you can do about that. But I'd say, no, wait, in the same scenario, there's this sexually contagious disease that destroys the human immune system and is globally epidemic. And I go, well, that's a bit too much. And I'd say, and terrorists from the Middle East have hijacked airplanes and flown them into the tallest buildings in New York. And the United States, in response, has invaded the wrong country. And they'd call security. But the world we live in is much, much more complicated than that. So we don't have, as I see it, we don't have the luxury of dreaming of a Star Trek future because, you know, we have too much, how do we get there from here going on to make that realistically possible. You can still do it. I mean, you can still do that kind of science fiction, but it requires far too much wishful thinking at this point to convince me. The science fiction I'd like to see, and it's not that I don't think it's the science fiction I'm ever going to write, but some of the science fiction I'd like to see is how step by step we could get there from here. Like how can we clean up the mess that we're leaving our great great grandchildren, and in doing so, I think causing them to, they're going to look back at us with utter contempt at very best.
Yeah, I got a question about the book specifically, Spook Country. Tito, the character, seems to me to be a little superhuman and at the same time naive in of the world. Do you feel that that's first off, can Tito the person actually exist, do you think?
Not to the extent that not as easily as Milgram could actually exist. Tito's pushed a little bit, but one of the things with a book like this is you perceive each character through each character's lens, you know, through each character's personality and each character's sense of the world. And Tito, as a fully blown practitioner of Santeria actually is having experientially the experiences of that, those gods talking to him mm-hmm. and helping him, whether that's actually happening in terms of the reality of the other characters is up to the reader. But Tito is convinced that it's going on.
Yeah, I saw that as an internalization, but I'm a bit of a atheist or such, so I didn't see that as an actual God manifestation. But in any case, do you think his actions and stuff is that of a person? Can a person really do the things he does? Or do you think you push that?
Oh, the back tucks and things yeah. like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I've seen, you know, there's some amazing stuff on YouTube if you want, you know, start poking around the parkour videos.
Right. Right, the people that run through cities and yeah. do amazing things.
Yeah, yeah, but when you start searching those, you start turning up other things. Obscure bits of martial arts. Yeah. I mean, he's not. Yeah, I don't know. He's not. He's meant to be on. I know what you mean about he's kind of superhuman, but he's meant to be. I was trying to get it like right on the border.
Yeah.
Like, is this possible, or is this not possible?
Yeah.
We have here a question from the internet. The time frame of your recent work has seemed somehow to be closer to the present and than some of your earlier so-called cyberspace work. This may be because changes in technology and society seem to be moving forward more quickly than before. Have there been cases where what seems like a scene from a dysfunctional future and later found out that it's something that's already happened? Or is this something you think about or worry about when you write?
No, I can think of one instance where I removed the description of a particular terrorist act from the galleys of a novel I published about 14 years ago, because I realized when I was going over the galleys that what I was proposing was so specific and so absolutely feasible and made so much sense in terms of large gesture from, you know, with minimal resources, that I simply didn't want to suggest it to anyone.
Because if that were to happen, you'd feel guilty.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, for that reason, I can't ever tell anyone what it was.
So it hasn't happened. That's good.
But, yeah, and it apparently hasn't occurred to anyone to do it. And maybe I hope it's occurred to someone else to make sure that no one can easily do it. But generally what I do to, you know, induce the illusion of a realistic future is to choose some environment that exists today on Earth, which I can then, you know, access and research, and just shift it. So if I shift the reality of a Brazilian shantytown to an orbital space station, I get great results generally, because I get all of this detail and it's all logically human. Mm-hmm. I don't really have to make it up. I just get it by shifting locale. There's remarkably little made, really like fully made up material in my early novels. It's, for the most part, it's all borrowing. Sometimes from the past, sometimes from some other part of the present. The criminal underground of Neuromancer and the two subsequent books, for instance, is based very, very closely on the Victorian criminal underground in London, how it was organized, and how there were literally guilds of pickpockets and muggers.
Now, in our final moments, we have an email question. which is from Alan. He asks, did you start all tomorrow's parties with the final scene in mind or imagine something beyond? And your thoughts on the singularity?
Well,
in 2 minutes.
Yeah. I didn't know what the final scene... I can't remember. I can't remember whether I had that image of the naked girl stepping simultaneously out of every fax machine on the planet. But I was trying to work with the idea of the singularity, and the idea of the singularity is that you can't write a science fiction novel beyond the point where it occurs. But subsequently, I've really questioned the extent to which I bought into the singularity. I think the first time I heard the phrase the geek rapture, I had to radically rethink the whole thing. And I now think it looks entirely too much like 13th century millennialism. It looks like a very old dream indeed.
We've been speaking with William Gibson. His new novel is Spook Country. William, we've got about a minute left here. Can you tell us what you're working on now? Have you started a new novel?
Not really. I haven't really started it, but I'm on the paperback tour for the last one, and the paperback tour has become sort of like the starting gun for the next book.
Everybody's waiting in anticipation.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Thank you for joining us, William Gibson, and we've had Sean Cleveland and Lyle Troxell. Thanks for joining us on Talk of the Bay.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Geek Speak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Geek Speak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Broadcasting in HD Radio on 88.9 FM, this is Central Coast Public Radio KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Arno, on the web at kosp.org. Coming up next is Castle Cottage in just a few moments. We're going to have the Slow County Report as well. For KOSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.